Welcome to another episode of The Shift with Elaine Agar. In this conversation, I talk with Amy Cates. She's an organization designer. She's also a senior managing director at Accenture. So she really brings a wealth of experience in organization design, really kind of understanding the nuances of today's modern leadership of how do we upskill people? How do we reskill? What are we doing for the future work, basically? And how do we do it effectively in organizations? So I find her really interesting. She comes from lots and lots of experience of understanding how to create healthy organizations and what does that even mean? And just really how to, you know, how to be a leader in a company and how to create opportunities for people to grow and upskill and reskill and so on. So super interesting conversation. Being in talent development space for me, it was really informative and educational. So enjoy the conversation. Let me know how it goes.
Amy, welcome to the Shift Podcast. I'm really excited to chat with you today.
Elena, thank you so much for having me here.
I have to give a shout out to Kamina, who is just such a networker, and I'm so glad she connected us. And it's been, you know, it's been really, really nice having chatted with you a little bit. You talk, you're not just you talk about things, your actual experience is in building healthy organizations, and you've done that throughout your career. And I'm really curious to hear a little bit more about your background story so that my audience can also experience it. And then we'll talk about what it looks like to prepare for future work and how to create healthy organizations.
Terrific, terrific. Yeah, I mean, the theme of my career has always been complex systems. I've been fascinated by complex systems. My graduate degree, my first work was in the field of city planning. I love cities, and I moved then from urban design into organization design. And I think cities and global organizations, global companies, are really humankind's most crowning achievements. I live in the middle of Manhattan in New York City, and I've really been privileged to work with some of the greatest companies around the world over the last 30 years as I've done my work in the field of what's called operating model and organization design, mostly as a partner in a small firm, Cates Kessler Organization Consulting with my partner, Greg Kessler. And in the last 4 years at Accenture as a managing director after our firm was acquired in June of 2020. And my focus over the last 4 years, in addition to client work, has been growing a practice. We came as 10, and we now have 150 practitioners around the world doing organization design.
Yeah, that's very nice. What made you, what did you study in school, like in your bachelor's, to back up a little bit? I'm just always curious, what do people end up studying? What did they end up doing? What was it that you knew, what was it that you wanted to study? And did it align with your interest earlier in your life?
Well, I wish it was a great story, but to be honest, I had one dream, and that was to live in New York City. I just was fascinated by New York. And when I was at school and I saw that there was something called urban studies and then city planning, maybe in a very simplistic way, I said, well, if I study that, then I have a reason to move to New York City. And it was no more complex than that. But to be honest, I love the work. What I love about it is both when it was city planning and now with the organization design is helping other people make good decisions. Right, understanding trade-offs, consequences, options. There's usually not a right answer and a wrong answer. There may be a better answer for a point in time or for a particular context, and really seeing those patterns and helping others sort those out, especially when they feel overwhelmed by complexity, is really what I see my work at.
And so what is a healthy organization? What are the elements of that? Can you define that for us?
Yeah, and I'll speak to it really from two perspectives. One, as a consultant working in so many different kinds of companies, not-for-profits, university, governments, many different countries and different stages of growth. But also, interestingly, in the last 4 years, being a leader in a company that has 725,000 people, which Accenture does and is quite complex in itself. What makes a healthy organization to start with is a clarity of purpose, a clear strategy, a why, and leadership that helps everybody understand the why of the organization and their part in it. And how the organization, the company, and again, I may say company, but it could be a not-for-profit, could be an institution, could be even a government agency, how it's going to deliver on that strategy. And then a healthy organization is aligned with that purpose and strategy. So structure, roles, power dynamics make sense given what we want to do. Processes, how we design decisions, the conversations that are created, the forums in which people come together to collaborate also make sense for that strategy. Our metrics and reward systems, and then our people practices. Who do we hire? What are the profiles? How do we develop people? How do we manage performance? What does good leadership look like? And you know, those who know org design know what I've just described as the J. Galbraith's STAR model, which is, you know, the premise is that a healthy organization is one that's clear in its strategy, and then the organizational elements are aligned to deliver that. And so people feel a congruence in the day-to-day and what's sort of stated by their leaders.
So speaking of leaders, there's a lot of push, of course, for well-being at work. It has been for the last several years. Yet we still, as a society, at least from some of the reports that I've seen, we're still more stressed out, more burnt out, more unhappy with our jobs than ever before, right? And on top of that, very insecure in our jobs, as employees because of layoffs and the trust is just no longer there. So when we talk about leadership, like how can leaders practice it in a way that's practical, that is, consistent, or maybe it's just that hard. Like maybe there's just not much of a solution to this.
It's a great question. And you know, I have two sons who are in their 20s, who are in the workforce, entering the workforce, and this is certainly something on their minds. And I look at their generational perspective on it as well, which I think is somewhat different than perhaps when I entered the workforce long ago. I think it goes back to that clarity of communication. And the problem is you know, people join companies, but they leave their manager and they leave their leader. Do they feel that the person who they're working with is competent? And these are the elements that I think of organizational trust in general that have been shown. Is that person competent? Do they respect them? Do they have credibility? And it's not just technical credibility, but do they have credibility to deliver on, you know, the resources and the promises that are made? And of course, middle managers often get cut, you know, caught in this kind of, you know, having to make promises that they can't deliver on. And so this congruence has to be all the way up and down the organization. It truly does start with the highest leadership. You know, are they able to say what they mean? Do they deliver on those commitments? But I think the piece that's often missing is the listening. What is important to my employees? What do they really want? For one, you know, young children or, you know, flexibility of time may be so important. For someone else, it's really challenge, promotion, career growth. For someone else, it might be, they want an opportunity to write or speak or go to a conference and connect externally and build their own personal brand and network. For someone else, it may be the quality of work. I want to practice my leadership and have an opportunity to have a supervisory position. That someone else might be, you know, I want a role where I have time to think, to be more of an individual contributor or researcher. Do it. I think there's not enough listening and thinking beyond job to thinking about how do I fit role to motivation. And I would say this is not new to millennials. This is not new to Gen Z. This has always been. People want their work to fit, you know, their motivation, which may change over time, and to be seen as an individual in that way. What's different now is there's an expectation that that's possible because there's such a variety of work today and a variety of work situations, you know, whether it's remote or work from home, and how people come to work, that the expectation that that's possible and seeing it as possible is much higher. So, and when there's expectation and it's not met, then I think disappointment is much greater.
It's you mentioned a couple of interesting points, and I tend to agree on the especially the mid managers. I actually just had a meeting this morning, and one of the concern was that a lot of the kind of rising managers, people that are, on the horizon to kind of be promoted and so on, actually don't want to be promoted because they see how stressful it is to be a manager, especially mid-level manager, where you're managing up, managing down across board and so on, and dealing with clients. It's like this idea that you want to grow in your career. Not everybody wants that, and I think Gen Zs want it less than other generations because, to exactly to your point, is they have other options now, and there's other options out there to monetize and to just lead a different life, right? And this whole the American dream, where we're gonna make this much money, we're gonna get a house, it's also is a concern right now for many young people, right? Like, so if you didn't get a house a few years ago, you're unlikely, like as a young professional, it's very difficult. So it's like, so why am I working 9 to 5 with a bad manager, and then on top of you want me to manage, like, for what? I can't even get a house, I can't even afford. So
Right.
I think there's a lot of, it's tough for them.
You say a lot of truth there. A couple of reactions. I would agree that being a manager is not an attractive role today, and in many cases, people become it because it's still the career path, right? It's the way up. But the reality is, if you want to grow in your work, you will have to manage. You will have to manage people. You'll have to manage projects. You'll have to manage processes. You'll have to manage strategy. You'll have to manage initiatives, whatever it is. And what we would be better off doing, and I think we don't do enough of this, is development of people and sort of honoring management. So there used to be a lot of management training, but it was sort of supervisory training. And to your point, there's a lot more to management. It's much more lateral. And how do I collaborate? And how does everything not feel like the team project from, high school? How do I manage up? How do I build influence? How do I sell a compelling idea? How do I present effectively? How do I understand political dynamics? None of this is learned in high school. None of this is learned in college, unless maybe you take some business courses, and there aren't really too many of those, or even organization behavior tends to be academic as opposed to personal. And I would say that companies would do well to invest. There's everybody's, technology training, AI training, all that kind of stuff. What about how do you live in an organization? How do you read the organization? How do you understand who are the stakeholders, the power players? How do you navigate and get resources? And we all see the people who are good at that, right? There's some people who are naturally good at that, and they might not even be able to explain what they do. But it tends to be, what I notice, is they're proactive. They're thinking, they're saying, ah, I have this project. Who should I be reaching out to right now? It's the old stakeholder map, that none of us ever use. But if we do it intuitively, and some of us need to do it more, more intentionally, but I think many people don't even know about these tools because it's sort of like, ah, that's old stuff, management. We don't value that kind of management. How do you give feedback? How do you observe actual behaviors and then know how to pre-understand the data that you're seeing in behaviors so you can give feedback to peers or even up? Especially and as well to your team. So that management becomes something, especially in lean organizations, lean, lean, lean is a productivity. What that means is then we are asking people to be managers on top of the day job. And Elaine, just to your point, I'm not being paid for that. I'm not being rewarded for it, monetarily or psychically. It's taking time. It's really stressful. It's no fun because a lot of it is, giving feedback, which is hard for all of us. So we aren't growing actually great managers today.
Yeah, and it's tough, and like you mentioned the point about being proactive, and I think the challenge is that a lot of companies and leadership are reactive versus proactive or preventive even in some cases, and it's this continuous rush to from one side, like business is business and we need to like make money and et cetera, but then if you don't pause long term, you're going to lose probably more money if the talent is not engaged because of turnover, because of a number of things, right? And I think that's probably the harder part for a lot of like special L&D folks like myself when you're, selling up to the leadership, the importance of X, Y, and Z. And I think some leaders are more open to it than others for sure. But I think it just becomes tough. And then, sometimes you're in a situation, you're like the middleman and you understand what the managers are going through, but then, the organization is just what it is. And it's like you almost have to accept it. And I see more organizations that way versus those that are like super proactive about their talent.
Yeah, I sense that you're talking from some personal experience here as you
Well,
reflect on
I
this.
do consulting. I've done a lot of consulting also for large organizations, and I've done trainings in large organizations, and that's the feedback that I see. And so many companies that are like amazing on paper, and you go in and you hear what's going on internally, and you're like, what? What? You're like blown, So, but anyway, not to go down that rabbit hole. So, and you brought up an important point about managing relationships, and I think that's an important factor as well in everything, right? And that's probably tough as well. So I work with a lot of younger people that are, fresh out of college or a few years of experience, a lot of techies. They tend to not be necessarily socially, motivated to go and mingle, and especially being in a remote environment, as so many people are these days still. So talk to me a little bit more about how do you navigate the politics? Can you learn it? Is it like, can you really learn politics, or is it innate? Like some people just know how to read the room and others don't.
Well, I think it's both. I think that some people are better at that, and they probably, been practicing it, and others, and I would put myself in this category, sort of not interested in it, kind of not maybe in tune to it. And again, coming into a big organization myself as a leader, coming in as a very senior leader, and all of a sudden having to think about these things, I have had to be intentional. So some of, I know myself, I'm a strong introvert. And had some bad practices, bad habits, one of which is, let me try and get the thing done. Let me try and work it so far so that when I share it with you, Elena, it's like kind of, do you like it? And it's almost too late for you to give feedback or say no. And that, of course, in a complex organization where people are matrix, where they collaborate and work together is just probably the worst habit one can have. So one of the things that we encourage people to do, we do sometimes training, managing in a matrix. How do you become intentional about building relationships in a 360 way, building influence, is to really force yourself to say, who should I be talking to right now? Ahead of time. Who should I be giving early information to? It's going to be messy. They're gonna raise all kinds of objections. They're gonna say why this won't work. They're gonna put roadblocks and stuff. But if I don't do it now, it's gonna happen later anyway. And I think this is the kind of place where, for executives, coaching is one of the most impactful kinds of things. How to be thinking about building influence. But for up and coming managers, who may not have the luxury of a coach, is actually find colleagues to be those kind of coaches. What should I be thinking of? And to your point earlier, this is the kind of place where slowing down a little bit, reducing frenzy, setting personal priorities, really has a lot of payoff, again, an impact. Is to think about, who's in my network that I can turn to for advice. I can bounce ideas. I can practice ahead, maybe a critical conversation. I can run a presentation by. If I don't have people that I could call and ask for that, and most people would be flattered to get that call, but it shouldn't be completely out of the blue. You have a little social capital in the bank, then I haven't been building my network. We use something again in some of our training. It's called a relationship map. And the idea is to say, Elena, who there's probably 10 people that you work with all the time. You're sort of transactional work. But who are the other 10 people that you should have that social capital in the bank that you want to be able to send an email or make a call to and ask for something and not feel uncomfortable? And then what can you do to proactively build that conversation, to build that relationship? And one of the things that I found really useful, because again, as an introvert, I sometimes find it uncomfortable even myself to just have a chit chat, is always to be on the lookout for interesting information. Be a curator and a connector. So I love connecting people together when I meet them. I love when I read something that's interesting to send it on to someone, say, hey, I was thinking of you. You might find this interesting. And those are the kinds of things that then build and say, I see you. I understand what's in of importance to you. I'm here thinking about you. And in organizational life, that helps to build relationship, especially when we're remote. And we don't have that chance to build sort of personal relationships informally.
Yeah, it's tough. And something else that's interesting that I've observed as I've kind of grown in my career is that as you grow and you build those relationships and so on, and you start to become in the you start to be part of conversations that happen at that senior level, and you're like, oh my God, like you feel like this whole other world has opened up to you because you're like, oh, I get it now. And there's a lot of times that information is not given to you until you reach a certain level. And then I had two realizations. One, again, some of it from personal experience, some of it just from, I have a lot of friends in senior roles as well. And we joke about it all the time because it's like you realize that nobody really knows what they're doing. A lot of times, like, just because somebody has a title of X, Y, and Z, which is to be respected, but you also realize that they're just humans trying to figure it out, and dealing and, going through problem solving and decision making. And that, by the time the decision comes to you, it's all like structured and ready to go. But the conversations that happen up top to get to that decision is not as smooth as you would imagine. So that was a realization number one. And then two, it's just you see things from a different perspective and you're like, oh, like, and you start to understand how some things work because now you have more information and just, so and it's hard because you can't always trickle that information down, right? Like in a senior position. So any thoughts of like, how a decision's made? Like, so the people that are in junior or mid roles are not frustrated continuously because they're like, why are we doing it this way? Sometimes it's because they're just guesswork. Like people are just, leadership's just guessing and experimenting. But sometimes there's a purpose to it, right? As well. And maybe experimenting is the purpose on its
Sure.
own, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that kind of frustration is absolutely justified and legitimate, and that is a symptom of an unhealthy organization. So let me bring we've talked a little bit about it, sort of interpersonal things, but let me bring it like an organizational design framework. And this is one of the most powerful frameworks when I bring to clients, and we call it layers of leadership. So every organization has a hierarchy, and hierarchy is not bad if they are what we say, not hierarchies just of status, but hierarchies of thought and focus. So a hierarchy of status is we have a biweekly meeting of the VPs. The VPs. So anybody who has a VP status, they come to this meeting. Well, that makes no sense because it doesn't necessarily mean those are the right voices or the right perspectives. It's in the room. It just means somebody at a particular level. As opposed to, do we have forums for information sharing, for decision making, for communication, whatever it is, that actually have the right people and the right roles in the room? So when we think about a hierarchy, we think of roles and layers of leadership. We think about it in sort of three big layers. There's one we call the strategic layer. And these are the folks who really set direction. So that purpose, strategy, priorities, trade-offs, right? And then communicate it. And this layer of leadership, whether it's executive team or it could be a few layers of leadership, and it can be, and as you go down in the organization for any given unit, there's a strategic layer, right? So even for a function, for an L&D, we have a strategic leadership that's laying out our strategy. Those folks, when they are together in that role wearing their hats, should actually slow down. They should be thinking more about, how do I sense and take in more information from the outside, from our own folks, turn that information into insights, feed it into our strategy, make fewer, bigger decisions, communicate with one voice, communicate over and over the purpose, the why. Here's what we're doing. Here's why we're not doing this. And this is the order of things. This is our portfolio of work. You know, here's why this group is doing this year, and this group is focused over here, and how it all fits together, how we're going to measure our success, what we should be worried about. And when I meet with any sort of executive team and I do an assessment that has shown that there's too much frenzy, they're making lots of decisions, but they're not actually listening and they're not communicating, but they think they're making, you know, it's great. We make a lot of decisions, a lot of throughput. And I tell them to slow down. They're like, but the world is, you know, everything's faster, faster. I said, because of that, somebody needs to do the slowing down.
Mm.
And when that layer slows down, then the next layer we call the integrative layer. These are the folks, often those mid-level managers, who we don't make enough time for them to meet together. It's hard, you know, it's not just the managing down, but to meet together, because they're the ones who create the systems, the processes, the ways of work that allow everyone else to collaborate. If they're well knit together, if they understand, if they are able to ask the questions and take the time to make sure they're all aligned on, yeah, we're clear on the strategy, the priorities, how our pieces fit together, how we need to work together to get the whole, then you have actually a system that empowers, you know, whether it's groups, it's teams, it's units, you know, whatever you have, the operational layer to go fast.
Hmm.
Then your group knows, you know, these are the programs we're getting out. This is the coaching we're doing. This is the performance we're trying to get at. This is how it fits with other people. This is, I've got my resources. I know where to go to. I know who I'm supposed to connect with. And I can go fast. I don't have to ask a lot of questions. I don't have to ask permission. I can go fast because the system's been set up. So the whole idea of inverting the pyramid, you know, and it's not a new idea, servant leadership, but truly bringing it to life in which we have our leaders working in service of our people, of our folks on the ground, and creating a system and creating the clarity so that they can actually make good, fast decisions.
Mm.
That's then we have something really healthy organization. And if you don't have that system, no amount of behavioral change is going to make a difference. No amount of people trying to collaborate or do the right thing is going to make a difference individually if they don't have a system that supports that, which is why organization design is, you know, talent and organization go together.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, system and processes are so important in organization, to your point. And, you know, you can have a person who does everything right, but if there's not a, you know, who follows up, but there's not a system or process to follow. And that's what a lot of companies actually struggle with, as you speak about it. I'm just thinking, you know, there's a lot of companies that struggle with that. Communication still, or miscommunication, lack of communication, whatever you want to call it, it's still the biggest challenge for a lot of companies because they don't put the right people in the room. The right people don't have all the information, right? Identify who those right people are is a whole other thing. And then making sure that those people actually follow the system. So collectively reinforcing, you know, following the system until it becomes such an engraved part of the culture, because that's another challenge, right? Because there's a lot of really great systems and processes, like we're gonna have a new process 2024, but then it's like you use it for a month and it just falls off. So, you know, to follow through is a whole other challenge, I think, for a lot of companies. Yeah.
Well, that creates trust, right? If we don't follow through, it's cynicism. I'll just wait for this to pass.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned culture. We would say, you know, culture is created by that system, what people really see. But if there's a mismatch between, you know, for instance, let's say, you know, the strategy and the stated culture is one of innovation. You know, we want to be a market leader. We want to innovate. We want to bring great experiences, product services, you know, to our customers. But the system, the organization punishes people for taking risk, for variability, for doing things, you know, staying within the bounds, mm-hmm. but doing things differently, for speaking up, then we probably will not get the kind of innovation that we want. Or we have suggestion box, we have, you know, ask for ideas, but we have no mechanism to vet those ideas, invest in them, prototype them, experiment with them. But there's no organization to do anything with ideas. Well, you know, we're not going to have We're not going to have innovation. So creating an organization that actually can deliver on the culture we want, the strategy, and the outcomes we want is so important. And then, of course, you know, sure, we need talented people, we need trained people, we need people with the right attitudes, we need the right experience. But that's necessary, but not sufficient.
And I do want to touch point before we wrap up this conversation on learning and how can we accelerate learning, particular in the age of AI and in the age of everything changing and so many things happening. Is there a way to accelerate learning in an organization?
You know, this is a great topic. I just spent the last 4 years in an experiment, taking up a challenge, which was in my domain, in my field, organization design, there's not very many org designers. And it's taken a long time for people to get good at the craft. I would have said 5 years ago that the ideal org designer was somebody who had 20 years of experience working in a company or consulting sort of organization or talent. And then, you know, so they were mature, you know, sort of courageous, you know, adult that could then learn the tools and techniques. Totally changed my mind. What we have done at Accenture, and it's something I'm really proud of our practice and the support that we've gotten, is we've been able to bring in to our group waves of good consultants who had a passion, but not necessarily experience in doing this kind of work. And they could come from all kinds of different consulting backgrounds. And we found that there's sort of a handful of things that accelerate learning. Number one is training, right? We have a common methodology and everybody learns it. And the common methodology is important because that way, you know, when you and I work together, we're not talking about definitions or terminology or process. We understand how to work together. Number two, then projects that practice that. So when people come in our group, they are just doing org design projects. They are working in teams where they are coached on the job and they are given feedback, and that every project is a learning project, and we're really explicit about that. Then most importantly, we make time for reflection. So everybody from the lowest consultant, you know, entry level consultant to our managing directors is continually turning their work into cases and presenting them back. What did I learn? How does this fit into the patterns? What's different in the context given this industry or this kind of company? How did the frameworks and the tools and the process work in this particular context? So we're learning from each other, but the importance is the presenting back, and then everybody teaches. So what we've been able to do is in our group of 150 is now we have programs and we are teaching, you know, the hundreds and the thousands and the next ring of consultants at Accenture. Everyone teaches. And this was really kind of, you know, groundbreaking there. It was, you know, even if you're coaching a learning pod, you have office hours, you're presenting, you're a faculty. We teach externally, we teach our clients. The practicing what you do, reflecting on it. I encourage people to write blogs. We publish a lot internally. You know, we don't make it a big thing. We just say, you know, 500 words about something. What have you learned? And then to teach. And that cycle has accelerated people's learning so much, because what we say is if you just have experience without reflection, it's just habit. It's the reflection, whether it's in the form of writing or teaching or presenting or whatever, that creates wisdom. And I really believe that this is this kind of approach, which takes time, it takes resources, it takes support internally, it takes, you know, a little bit, as you say, the you know, stepping back from the frenzy and having to say no to other things. We have been able to, in, you know, 3-4 years to give people an experience that took me personally 15 years to have.
Yeah, I love that approach. It's so, it's that collaborative approach, because we don't know what we don't know. And if we don't pause to reflect, and then on top of that, being able to teach something back, it just solidifies everything else in our minds. And it's, I absolutely love it. I mean, I absolutely love it. It's like that saying. It's like forget the actual quote, but it's like you want to, be good at something, learn it. You want to be great at something, teach it type thing, right? And it's funny because I do training as well, of course. And if I do it like on emotional intelligence, every session, I learn something new. Every time I teach it, every time, and I've been talking about emotional intelligence for probably, I don't know, 7 years now. And every class is different. Every person I talk to, every group is different. And you learn so much about yourself throughout that process. It's by far my favorite thing to do is to deliver training because it's so selfishly fulfilling for me and I learn so much.
Exactly. You know, I often say this, I love theater, you know, in Broadway, and I used to wonder, like, how does someone stand up there, you know, 8 times a week and just do the same thing over and over? And I'm like, that could be boring. Until I met somebody who was in that, and they said, no, once you learn, once you're, then every time you're not thinking about the mechanics of it, you go deeper, you're feeding off the audience, you're at another level. And in my own work, you know, I've taught some of the same things 1,000 times. And that's exactly, someone asks a question slightly differently, it makes me think in a different way. Or when I'm with a client, I can now get out of my head because I'm confident in, you know, what I do because I've been teaching, and I'm really listening. I'm really looking at the dynamics and seeing unarticulated questions and drawing them out. And so all of it is a virtuous cycle of consulting, of facilitating, of working with executive teams, then reflecting, turning it into some insights, sharing it, being generous. You know, our practice now is very involved in our professional associations. I think it's just the right thing to do, that we should support our, but it's part of a value of generosity of share. It builds our field, and it also benefits you as the individual. So I think learning, I love, you know, this podcast, I mean, I started listening to podcasts. My kids sort of introduced me to the whole idea of continually, there's so much good stuff out there. And I think there's a real thirst, you know, people can get overwhelmed by what I don't know and what I could know. But that's, you know, pick a few things to be excellent at and go deep, you know, while you become a generalist and open to many.
Yeah,
Yeah,
beautiful.
you hit on a topic that's been a particular passion of mine, and I'm excited to continue that work in the future.
Yeah, no, it's very insightful, and I love that approach. I look forward to hopefully chatting again and kind of seeing how things have evolved and some of the other research maybe you've done on this and so on. I'd love to chat again. Where can people find you and get in touch with you if somebody just wants to reach out?
Yeah, so I'm right in the process of retiring from Accenture. My work there is done, and I'm going to go back to private practice. So there's a few places you can find me on LinkedIn, under Amy Cates. I also have a channel called Operating Model and Organization Design, and we use that to just share blogs and information about the field. So if you're interested in organization design, Operating Model and Org Design channel on LinkedIn, but you can find me at amy@amycates.com, and always love to chat with people and who are particularly interested in the field.
I'll make sure to share all of that in the show notes as well for those who are listening. And the
Yeah.
last question I always ask all of my guests, it's became sort of a tradition, is what is one question you wish people would ask themselves more often?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to share with you what I learned from the honor and privilege of having an executive coach, which is what do I personally need to be more intentional about? So it's back to our earlier conversation. We all have our habits, we have our strengths, we have our go-tos that work really well. But if we really want to grow, we have to do the things that are uncomfortable. And we have to continually ask ourselves, you know, it's not enough to look around and say, oh, that comes easy to other people. That's just not me. No. What do I need to do to be intentional about it? And when I ask myself that, it's really powerful. Then it just comes to me. I say, ah, Today's here's what I need to be practicing.
Very practical. Yes. It's one of those things that we forget to do. We're just so busy. We're doing, and we're like, but what is it that I need to actually do? Right. So it's
What's my practice, right? Where life is a process of becoming who we're meant to be, and so we need to be continually practicing it. Then to do that, we need to be intentional. So that's where I've been lately.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, this has been a real pleasure, Eleni. Great questions. Love your enthusiasm and energy, and thank you for having me on.